So it's a pleasure to be here, having just flown in a few hours ago. If some of the handwritten transparencies are a little messy, it's because of turbulence. Here's the title that was advertised with young neutron stars. Really, I'm going to be talking mainly about radio pulsars. Here's sort of an overview of what I'm going to talk about. This is going to be a very observational talk. So if you have, I would like it to be informal also, so don't hesitate to stop and ask or discuss anything that I say. Here's sort of an overview. I'm just going to give you a brief introduction to observational issues in radio pulsars. I'll talk a little bit about pulsar timing, and then I'm going to spend some time talking about pulsar spin evolution and ages and implications for initial spin periods of pulsars, something that Lars thought would be of particular interest to many people in the audience. I'm going to give you a few concrete examples of what I'm referring to, objects in the sky that will be of particular relevance to that topic. And then if I have time, I'm going to talk a little bit about what we can do, what we can hope for or not hope for in finding new objects, particularly those fast pulsars that would have had very short initial spin periods at birth. So here's your introduction to observational radio pulsar issues. I'm sure this is a review for many of you, but the latest, just so that you know, the latest published catalog has 708 radio pulsars in it. There's actually about 1,200 known that have yet to be published, but I'll talk about that later. As you know, they're a galactic plane population. These are broadband sources. They emit from radio up to gamma rays, although the vast majority are observed only at radio waves, simply because they're not bright enough at the shorter wavelengths. The very brightest sources you can detect in X-rays very easily, some in gamma rays, very few optically. But the bulk of the population you see at radio. At radio wavelengths, they're characterized by very narrow pulse profiles, and I've chosen to highlight the observational issues that are that will be of relevance later. Here's the Crab pulsar at 1.4 gigahertz. This is the result of summing something like 1,000 individual pulses. You see that it actually has a main pulse and a little interpulse. That's actually not that common. Most pulsars just have a main pulse that looks something like that. In this case, as you all know, the pulsar period is about 33 milliseconds. The range of periods of the known pulsar population is between 1.5 milliseconds and all the way up to 8.5 seconds. There's a radio pulsar that spins that slowly. On either end, I think it is quite fair to say that the absence of sources could well completely be dominated by observational selection effects. These radio pulsars, of course, they're very famous because they spin down very regularly. All of these sources are losing energy slowly due to magnetic dipole radiation. And they do so in a very regular way so that these are excellent clocks. And of course, there's some exceptions to this, particularly among the young neutron stars, and this is going to be very important later. They're known to glitch and also show timing noise. And let me make very clear what I mean by those two issues. First of all, when we talk about pulsar timing, and I want to get into this in a bit more quantitatively, talk about pulsar timing, observationally speaking, we can characterize the time evolution of the pulsar spin frequency by a Taylor expansion, so that the frequency at any time is equal to some initial frequency plus the frequency derivative, et cetera. Now, what we actually do in pulsar timing is not, rather than measure frequencies at different epochs to measure various spin parameters and study the evolution that way, a much more precise way to do timing and to establish the spin evolution of the pulsar. And why you'd want to do that will become clear shortly, why these parameters are interesting to measure, is through actually observing or using the integral of this equation, the phase is a function of time, where what you measure precisely is a pulse phase at any epoch, that is some fiducial point in the pulsar profile, usually the peak of the pulse. And by measuring these very precise phases at many epochs, you can then determine the spin parameters, the frequency derivative, and occasionally a second frequency derivative is necessary, just by studying what we call the residuals, which is the difference between the measured pulse phase and what your model, which includes those parameters, would have predicted. That's called a residual, and you want your residuals to be zero. And for a very stable pulsar, in fact it is, here's a pulsar where the residuals over something like 8 years are only a few microseconds. This is a very stable clock. In fact, this is the most stable clock. This is a millisecond pulsar, in fact, if your eyes are good, you can sort of start to detect a bit of a deviation. Of course, if your residuals are zero, then your model parameters are very good, and you're predicting phases extremely well. Now, when you do timing, of course, phase coherent, meaning measuring the phases, if your frequency is slightly off, your residuals will be characterized by a linear trend in time. If your frequency derivative is slightly off, your residuals are characterized by a parabola. And so these are the sorts of things you look for in residuals, and this is how you improve the model. And finally, if your frequency's second derivative is off, of course, you get a cubic. So I'm emphasizing this for a reason you'll see shortly. Now, glitches, as you all know, here's a glitch in the Vela pulsar. Here's the pulse period versus time. What happens in the Vela pulsar and pulsars of comparable age is that the period is increasing and suddenly decreases. It spins up, but then continues to increase again. Or equivalently, in the residuals, you see zero residuals and then suddenly a slope change because of the change in frequency. So now, when you're doing pulsar timing, for young pulsars, glitches mess things up, and they're not such stable rotators. Similarly, I mentioned in this introduction that not only do you have to worry about glitches, but there's also this phenomenon called, you know, when you don't know what something is, you call it noise. So we call this timing noise, but we really don't know what the origin is, or maybe some of you do, but I certainly don't. This is simply random wanderings, either of the phase or the frequency, at a fairly low level in the pulsar rotation, and that manifests itself as deviations from zero residual. So here's an example. I'm actually cheating here. This isn't a radio pulsar. This is an anomalous X-ray pulsar, but it does the same thing as a radio pulsar, so I can get away with it. Basically, these are residuals here in units of the pulse period. You see, they're not perfectly zero. There's actually a cubic term here. You might say, oh, that's the second derivative that I told you about. But in fact, if you were to this second derivative is not a stationary quantity. It varies. So from year to year, you will measure different second frequency derivatives. And this is a noise process. If we continue to observe this pulsar, you would start to observe quartic terms and quintic terms and, well, whatever the next term would be, but in the Taylor expansion of this irregular spin depth. If you just think about it in terms of periods, it's not that much larger. Yeah, this is similar. Yeah, that's why I chose this one. But if don't look, pretend this is microseconds on this axis. It's actually not, but it was late. Okay. So the last observational point I just wanted to bring up. Of course, you all know that the emission that you observe from the radio all the way to the gamma rays, and including any particle winds, etc. This is all powered by the spin down of the pulsar. Of course, the conventional pulsar emission that you see is non-thermal, although the Young sources also show some thermal emission. But just to make very clear and what I mean by the being powered by spin down, well, you know the spin down luminosity. You've all seen this, I'm sure. This is rotational kinetic energy. Here's the time derivative of the rotational kinetic energy. I here is the moment of inertia of the neutron star. And then you just look up your classical electrodynamics, and you have a magnetic moment here. And this is a very simplified version of what's going on. But if you equate the rate of loss of kinetic energy to this magnetic dipole radiation term, what you can see very clearly is that the rate of change of the angular velocity, omega dot, is proportional to omega cubed. Or you could write it as omega dot equals some constant, which has to do with the magnetic moment and the moment of inertia, is proportional to omega, the spin angular frequency, to some power n, where if it's a simple dipole, n is basically equal to 3. Okay? And n, that is called the breaking index. And if you can measure n, and it's not hard to show just from that Taylor expansion that, rather from that expression I had right there, it's two lines of algebra, just to show that you can measure n and determine it, and therefore test that very simple dipole model just by measuring the frequency, that's easy. Frequency derivative, that's also easy. The second frequency derivative, that one's harder. The reason that one's harder is because of the timing noise and the glitches that I mentioned. Okay, so there's spin irregularities that make this quantity difficult to measure. However, it has been done for some sources. Here are the cases where one has measured a stationary second frequency derivative, doesn't change with time, so that you know you're measuring truly this breaking index. Five cases have been measured: the Crab, pulsar 1509-58, the Crab twin in the LMC, this is a 50 millisecond pulsar 0540-69, and this very recent result just published just this year. Our group, led by Fernando Camillo, has measured breaking index, actually the first one that's actually close to 3. This measurement has been revised with subsequent timing, 2.91 plus or minus 0.05. The fifth measured breaking index is really low. It's 1.4 plus or minus 0.2. That's the Vela pulsar. I put it in brackets quite deliberately, and that's because the technique for measurement of that particular breaking index is different from the other four. For the other four, the technique is exactly what I described to you. This phase coherent timing method, where you measure the phase at multiple epochs, study the residuals, determine a second frequency derivative, and calculate the breaking index that way. For this pulsar, because it is an extremely active glitcher, as you all know, that technique doesn't work. As soon as you get close to measuring the breaking index, the pulsar glitches again. So you can't ever measure it in that way. What Line et al. Did in 1996, Nature paper, instead is calculate it using something like 25 years of data and measuring the apparent change in the frequency derivative on top of the glitches. So it's a very different way of doing it, and it's not tested. It hasn't been done for the other sources to compare and make sure you get the same thing.
In the other cases, you measure glitches?
Well, yes, that's right. So for the Crab pulsar, it's such a huge effect that you can measure it. And the Crab pulsar glitches are much less frequent also. They don't happen as often as in Vela. So you have enough time to measure it. This source has never glitched. Why? I don't know. This source, actually, I should say, I should slightly correct myself. This source, the breaking index, has not been measured from phase coherent timing, but it's almost as good as that, and it's not clear whether it glitches or not, but that's probably as good a value as any of the others. I should probably put a little asterisk there. It's just this one is not observable in the at radio frequencies, only in X-rays. And so you have to do it by actually directly measuring the change in frequency derivative. In any case, and this one, it has glitched, but we had enough time to measure the breaking index. Yeah, this one has a pulse period of 400 milliseconds, characteristic age of 1.6. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, that's a whole other talk. That's very interesting why that one came out so close to 3. Yeah, that's coming up. Okay, well, the deck, just to not to keep you waiting, breaking index has not been measured for that. Right, yeah. And I'm about to get to that, actually. In fact, okay, so I made a fuss of making clear where this equation came from. If you then go ahead and integrate it with respect to time, under the assumption that that constant k is in fact a constant, maybe that's that. Remember that thing had in it the magnetic field, the magnetic moment, the moment of inertia. We're assuming, if you assume that's a constant, then you can integrate this to determine the true age of the pulsar. It's not hard. It's a page of algebra, something like that. Here's what you get. This is the age of the pulsar. This is the frequency at the current age, and this is the frequency at birth. N is the breaking index. Equivalently, you can write it in terms of periods. This is what it looks like in terms of periods. What people most commonly, in pulsar astronomy, most commonly refer to as the age of the pulsar is actually an approximation to these expressions. It's merely the characteristic age of the pulsar, with a little c here. That's at least how I denote it, which is just p over 2 p dot, which comes from assuming that the initial spin period is negligible compared to the present spin period, so that this term just disappears, and assuming n is equal to 3, which it's not in general. So this is what people talk about as the age of the pulsar. And yes, that's not necessarily the true age, but it's probably a reasonable approximation to ages. That's the range that you get for characteristic ages in the pulsar population. Here's a p dot plot. This is the log of the pulse period on the x-axis and the log of the period derivative on the y-axis. Each dot represents a radio pulsar, and these are lines of constant characteristic age. In the other direction, these are lines, incidentally, of constant inferred magnetic field, assuming a simple dipole model, but we're not going to talk about those today. Main point is that if you look at where the youngest pulsar, and in fact, actually, I think I'm missing a couple points on this plot, but it still makes the point. If you look at where the youngest pulsars are, just according to characteristic age, and you look at what sources are very, very plausibly associated with supernova remnants, which is presumably a valid independent age estimator, you find that, in fact, the youngest ones by characteristic age are also the ones that are most plausibly associated with supernova remnants. Now, that's sort of a bit of a shaky argument because associating things with supernova remnants is not a simple business, but the point is the characteristic age mainly works, but it doesn't necessarily work in detail. Now, just to go back to this expression for the age, if you know the breaking index, and if you know the true age of the pulsar, then you can solve for the initial spin period of the pulsar, and only then. There is only one source for which you know all of that, and that's the Crab pulsar. The N is measured. You know the age because the supernova was observed. This transparency is a little old, sorry. The point is you can solve for the initial spin period. But generally speaking, we didn't observe the supernovae that produced the pulsar. generally speaking, we can't measure the breaking index because of glitches and timing noise. So generally speaking, we don't know what the initial spin periods are. Let me give you an example of what I mean. This is an illustrative example only, because there's actually other reasons. There's reasons to believe that this pulsar supernova remnant association doesn't hold, but it makes a nice case just to illustrate exactly what I mean here. This is a well-known supernova remnant, RCW-103. This was not my choice of color scales. This is an X-ray image from the Einstein Observatory. It has also since been observed with Chandra, but that data is not yet public, so I haven't seen it and I can't show it to you. In fact, there's actually a neutron star candidate associated with the supernova remnant at the center here. It's actually a really weird source. It is not at all a radio pulsar. But never mind that. Recently, a radio pulsar has been detected somewhere over here. It was just outside the field of view of this particular observation. The radio pulsar is extremely young, okay? And one can ask, could it be associated with a supernova remnant? The answer is probably no, because why is it so far out? It would have to have had a huge kick velocity to reach the outskirts of the supernova remnant in a short time. But let's just ask that question. The age, let's ask that question. In this case, of course, we don't know when the supernova went off. However, there are estimates of how old this remnant is. The best estimate is about 2,000 years. Okay. In this case, the uncertainty is dominated mainly by the distance. Distances to supernova remnants are very poorly known. Okay, so what you normally do in supernova remnants, I mean, one way to estimate the age is just to see the size, and you know roughly what the expansion velocity should be, and so if you know the distance, you can know the age. In this case, you don't really know that, you know the distance only so well, but the expansion velocity has been measured directly, and so if you believe the distance, then probably the age is good to within a factor of 2 or something like that. Now here's a plot, basically, of the possible age initial spin period parameter space for this pulsar. Now I'm assuming the objects are associated. They're actually not, but let's pretend for a moment they might be. Now what's plotted here? This is true age of the pulsar on the y-axis. This is the initial spin period at birth. Okay, and what are these are lines of allowed phase space for different breaking indexes. Okay, so what do I mean here? This is a 69 millisecond pulsar. So if this pulsar was born yesterday, so its age is 0, then its current initial spin period, of course, would be equal to the current spin period. Okay. If the pulsar was rotating like a simple magnetic dipole, had a breaking index of 3, and the initial spin period was much less than the current spin period, its characteristic age, indicated by this dot, would be about 8 kiloyears. Okay. If the breaking index is smaller, then for 0 initial spin period, of course, the age of the pulsar could be much larger. Yeah. That's something that it's a possibility. Yeah, and so one thing you could try and do is measure the proper motion of the pulsar. That's something that one could do. But let's say you said that they were associated, which is it's not impossible. In this case, the age of the supernova remnant is relatively well determined to be about 2,000 years. So if this is the age, then independent of what the breaking index is, the initial spin period had to have been pretty close to the current spin period. That's what this plot is telling you. Okay. Now in this case, the association isn't that strong, but there are cases where the association is quite strong. Here's another supernova remnant. The best image I could show you of this, we actually just got Chandra data on it literally last week, but I haven't gotten to see it. And this is a simulation, and wow, if the lights were off, it would look gorgeous. These are just gaps between the CCDs, so never mind that. There's a shell here. This is a supernova remnant called G11.2 minus 0.3. There's a shell here of thermal emission, there is a pulsar here and there is a pulsar wind nebula also here. None of this has ever been seen with anywhere near this resolution. We're awaiting Chandra to actually see what's really going on here. This is an OSCA image simulated in for Chandra. In any case, the point is that this pulsar detected in X-rays, it has a period of 65 milliseconds. Now, this supernova remnant is known to be very young, on the order of maybe 1,000 years or 2,000 years from its spectrum. And it has been very plausibly argued to be associated with an observed supernova that occurred in 386 AD. It's not as firm as the crab, but it is quite plausible. This is an X-ray pulsar. We didn't detect the radio pulsar, but what I really want to get at here is that the characteristic age of the pulsar has been measured. In this case, it is about 23,000 years old. The fact that it's right at the center of the supernova remnant means, you know, it's probably associated with this remnant. How can you reconcile the fact that the characteristic age is a factor of 10 greater than the age of the supernova remnant, especially if it really was observed? Well, if you believe that this gives you the true age, then the initial spin period has to be very close to what it is today, namely around 65 milliseconds. And that is independent of what the breaking index is. Here's another case where the age of the pulsar seems to be discrepant with the true age. This is what Dong was just asking me about. This is the famous duck supernova remnant, G5.4-1.2. This is a VLA image that Dale Frail lent me. Basically, this is a shell of emission here, and you see this little thing sticking out of it. Let's just call that a little radio blob for the moment, and let me blow up just a little region around that radio blob and look at it at a shorter wavelength. So you see higher spatial resolution, and that's what it looks like. Okay? And what Dong was alluding to, there's a pulsar right here, a young pulsar. That's right here. Its characteristic age is 16,000 years. Okay? No breaking index has been measured for it. Now, if you assume that this pulsar was born at the center of the large supernova remnant, then in 16,000 years to have moved so far away, and this morphology is extremely suggestive, that it's moving with high velocity, so it seems pretty plausible, it needs to have a proper motion that is extremely large, easily measurable with the VLA, something like 70 milliarcseconds per year. That's if it was born at the center of the supernova remnant, which we don't know for sure. It could be chance alignment on the sky, but let's just say if, because it's very likely, I mean, let's face it. However, what Gainsler and Frail have just reported in an issue of Nature last month, as I said, for this pulsar, the characteristic age is 16,000 years. The distance is actually fairly well known to this system. You expect a proper motion of 70 milliarcseconds per year. Actually, that's independent of the distance. It's a proper motion. It doesn't matter what the distance is. So the proper motion they measure is less than 25 milliarcseconds per year. Oh, in kilometers per second, that's something like 1,500 kilometers per second. And their 5 sigma upper limit on the proper motion is 25 milliarcseconds per year. So the pulsar is not moving, which is really sad. But, you know, you have to just pick up the pieces and move on and try and figure out, well, what does that mean? Yeah. Which one? The first one? Well, and that has been speculated as additional evidence for the association. So you'd say. Let's see. So if it's moving, then it would be moving slower.
So it would require a lower velocity to move from the actual position of the explosion.
This is, I see what you're, what you're saying. That's, no. I don't, to the best of my knowledge, there's no evidence that it is denser on that side. And in fact, this emission is actually thought to be more related to the pulsar having passed through. In fact, if you measure the spectral index of the emission as a function of distance from the pulsar, it monotonically either increases or decreases away. What does it have to do? It has to steepen as it moves away from the pulsar. Where did I put what? Oh, the center that is about here. And the 70 milliarc seconds is actually really what they, if you take a reasonable range for where the center could be, it's somewhere between, what they quote in their paper is, I think something like 60 to 80. And I just told you 70 because that was in the middle of their range. Yeah, well, the thing is, so you could ask, okay, how can you test it? How can you test it? And one way to test it that that I see, or a possible way to test it is, this source has never been observed in the X-rays, and a young supernova remnant would have different properties from an old supernova remnant in the X-rays. And we just got Chandra data on this source also, so that should help to resolve whether or not this is really old, because so what at least Gainsler and Frail conclude is that the system has to be, if you're still going to associate it and you are going to assume roughly that that is the center, the system has to be a lot older than the characteristic age indicates, which suggests that the breaking index is very small. In fact, you need a breaking index of roughly what has been measured for the Vela pulsar. So what they're suggesting is that breaking indexes can very commonly be as low as 1.5.
If the values of the breaking indices are not what the model predicts, how do we know that the breaking indices
are constant? Constant in time? That's a fair question, because you don't know that for sure. He does. It predicts. Yes, it does. Well, it's sort of predictive. It's not 100% predictive if you read it in detail, because he needs to know the angle between the spin axis and the magnetic axis, which you don't know. That's a reasonable point. I've seen that point made, but it hasn't been observed directly except for that argument. Yes. Yeah, me. We had once, the 1509 minus 58, because it's never glitched, we have measured the third derivative. And, well, actually, we've measured it a lot more precisely now, and that work is still in progress. Right. Well, I mean, it's also, if I knew the answer for sure, I would tell you. But I don't feel comfortable. It's too preliminary. It's work in progress in a big way. Anyway, the point is, you know, you could say, well, I think I've already made this point, and you're all aware of it. Basically, age estimates for supernova remnants are very uncertain. So to get an independent age estimate is going to tell you what the initial spin period is, even if you knew the breaking index, is very hard. There is one pulsar, of course, that's particularly interesting probably to this audience. This is pulsar 0537 minus 6910 in the LMC. This is a 16 millisecond pulsar in the supernova remnant N157b. No radio pulsar has been detected. That's not surprising, actually. The LMC is pretty far away. The best age estimate for the supernova remnant is about 5 kilo-years. And given that this source is in the LMC, that means the distance is actually quite well constrained compared to any other supernova remnant in the galaxy. However, still, you don't know really what, you know, these things expand at some velocity, which hasn't been well measured, and they expand into ambient mediums of different densities. So just knowing what the true size is and estimating what the expansion velocity is, this number is probably good to something like a factor of 2. This actually was meant for a different audience. You all know that this small this suggests a small initial spin period, which could be very interesting. Let's say you make one of those plots for this pulsar, which I did for you. Again, this is it's a phase space plot. So I'm not actually, it's not really an X versus Y. This is an initial spin period on this axis, which is unknown. And this is the true age of the pulsar. Of course, the current spin period is 16 milliseconds. If the characteristic age of the pulsar, which is 5,000 years, is the true age of the system, then the initial spin period was very, very small. P over 2 P dot, yeah. Yeah, that's also 5,000 years. Yeah. And so that's why this dotted line, which is the estimated age of the supernova remnant, happens to go through that point. But of course, we know already characteristic ages of pulsars are not that reliable. And the age of the supernova remnant is actually really, I mean, I think a factor of 2 is probably reasonable. If the true age of the supernova remnant was 3,000 years, which is quite plausible, then independent of the breaking index, the initial spin period would be in the range of about 10 milliseconds. On the other hand, if the pulsar, the true age was larger, or sorry, if the true age of the system was larger, well, that's fine as long as either the initial spin period is non-negligible or the breaking index is quite small. Unfortunately, this pulsar has not been cooperating. It ought to allow its breaking index to be measured, which would at least nail down one parameter. It glitched in a big way, and in spite of efforts to time it with XTE, a breaking index has not been forthcoming. How am I doing for time? Okay. What I thought I'd talk about just toward the end is what are the prospects? That pulsar is unique because it really does tell you something that the spin period, you know, at least you know for sure. The spin period had to be less than 16 milliseconds. Whether it was 10, whether it was 5, we don't know. What are the prospects for finding more like that? Because if one of the uncertainties is the age of the supernova remnant, let's hope that at least that uncertainty is random. If we could find enough of them, we could hope to say something more useful about initial spin periods. So are we going to find more of these? This is a list of all the known radio pulsars, I should say rotation-powered pulsars, with, and that should have had a C there, characteristic age less than 25,000 years. Here they all, there's a crab. These are ordered by characteristic age. 1509, there's the 16 millisecond guy. And just look at this particular column. You can ignore all the other stuff. Look at this column. What was the radio band it was found in? Okay. The bulk of these, as I asserted right at the start, most radio pulsars were found and still observed only in radio waves. There's a handful that are detected in X-rays. The fact that this was detected in X-rays, the fact that the 16 millisecond pulsar was detected in X-rays is not a coincidence. it would be very hard to detect radio waves. Not impossible. Why do I say that? Well, how do we go about searching for radio pulsars? There's sort of four elements to searching. You might assume we do Fourier transforms, which is of course true. We look at the point on the sky, sample the radio power as fast as we like, sometimes faster than a millisecond, sometimes only 80 microseconds. But before we can even do that, we must correct for the fact that there's interstellar dispersion. And that is really a major issue in searching for these things. Basically, the cold plasma dispersion law says that the time delay goes as 1 over frequency squared, so that the higher frequencies arrive earlier than the lower frequencies. Actually, perhaps a better plot to show you first would be some actual data rather than a schematic plot. This is a very bright pulsar. This is radio frequency on this axis, pulse phase on this axis, and here you see the pulse arriving early at the high frequencies, later at the low frequencies, and if your eyes are good, you see that's a parabola, and the time delay goes as 1 over frequency squared. The way we correct for that is to break the radio band up into lots of little pieces and delay them and then sum them. And of course, we don't know exactly how much to delay it. That's the parameter you have to search for. However, even if you break it up quite finely, you are always left with some residual DM smearing due to the fact that the pieces of the band that you're breaking up have finite radio frequency. So the differential within one region of radio frequency space, the differential smearing, the residual DM smearing, goes as 1 over frequency cubed times that's the bandwidth of your individual channels. So that's a problem, because if you want to find fast pulsars, your pulse is slightly smeared by this by the dispersion measure, even if you've channelized your data quite fine. Now, in principle, you can improve just by breaking your bandwidth into smaller and smaller little pieces, but that gets computationally difficult. Another problem, which is a lot harder, which at least DM smearing you could in principle solve, but another problem at radio wavelengths is scattering by inhomogeneities in the electron density. Of course, the dispersion measure is just the integrated electron density along the line of sight. But if those electrons are not distributed uniformly, you can get scattering of the radio waves, where some radio waves that wouldn't have ended up coming towards you get scattered off a blob back into your line of sight, so that some of the emission gets delayed and you get the original pulse profile as you would have seen it sitting on the pulsar, convolved with basically an exponential tail. And the time scale, the characteristic time of this exponential with which the original pulse got convolved, is a scattering time that goes as frequency to the minus 4.4 power. So it's highly frequency dependent. So and you can't beat this. I mean, it's in the interstellar medians. The only thing you can do is to go to higher frequency where this term gets small. Otherwise, you're smearing out your pulses. And why does that really matter? Well, when you think about searching for pulsars, just look at this plot here. Here are your individual pulses as a function of time. The Fourier transform of this is this, where you see the fundamental and you see all of the harmonics due to the fact that it's not a perfect sinusoid. But as you smear this out, these extra harmonics disappear. And when we search for pulsars, we make use of the fact that you expect non-sinusoidal pulses, and we co-add all of these harmonics. As you smear out the signal, you lose sensitivity to higher harmonics, you lose sensitivity to your signal. So at radio wavelengths, fast signals, particularly those in directions like, say, the galactic plane, where you expect all the young sources to reside, as opposed to millisecond pulsars, which are not all in the galactic plane. So even though they're faster, you can still find them. Young pulsars in the galactic plane are hard to find at radio wavelengths. So in searching, basically, well, obviously you want a wide bandwidth, but of course you want narrow filters to be able to remove dispersion smearing. You want a short sampling, this you all realize. But the fact is that going to higher frequency to mitigate the scattering is a problem because pulsars are more have steep spectral indices, so they're brighter at lower frequencies. So you sort of, you have a problem unless somebody's going to build us a nice square kilometer array. And so just to mention, some of you may have heard about a survey that we're doing at the Parkes Telescope in Australia, 64-meter telescope. This is making use of a new receiver. I have to show you some of the instruments we use, right? I realize that that you're not observers, so this doesn't thrill you like it does me. But anyway, that's the instrument that we're using. Basically, this is 13 separate receivers in the focal plane. This is right now being hoisted up to the focus. We can look at 13 separate positions on the sky simultaneously. So it allows us to observe for a very long time and get good sensitivity. Are we going to find young pulsars with this? We're surveying the galactic plane. Well, we're doing this at a relatively high radio frequency specifically to avoid the dispersion and the scattering problems. Previous surveys at the frequency we're at, or the wavelength 20 centimeters, have been quite successful, so this was seemed promising when we started. There's only been two surveys that have gone to such a high frequency. Most pulsars were found at much lower frequency, which is going to be bad for finding young pulsars in the galactic plane. Clifton et al. Found 40 new young pulsars, including including some of the youngest pulsars that were in that list. Similarly, Johnston et al. Also found 42. So these were very successful, which suggested that this survey would be also very successful. To date, we have found 523 new pulsars. So this is an extremely successful survey. I'll just leave you with that number and skip all this other stuff, which is meant for another talk. But what I really wanted to show you is that, yes, we're pumping out pulsars really, really fast. We have basically a whole new population of pulsars to play with. But let me show you the survey sensitivity. Even though this is a tremendously productive survey, what's plotted here is pulse period on the x-axis and the minimum detectable flux density on the y-axis for this very productive survey. For a pulsar, like you might want to find, say, around 10 milliseconds, a young pulsar in the galactic plane, when you get toward the galactic center, the dispersion measures are, these are curves for different dispersion measures, toward the center of the galaxy at about 5 or 6 kiloparsecs, the dispersion measure is already about 500. You see that you're already, the minimum flux density detectable is quite high at the short periods. So this, we would have a lot of trouble detecting the N157B pulsar in this radio search, unless it was relatively nearby. And this is, that prediction is amply borne out by the population of pulsars we've discovered. This is the, I guess this is, the plot didn't come out quite as I had hoped. This is a distribution of the pulse periods of the new pulsars and the old pulsars known in the catalog. Those are in the white histogram. You see that we're tending to find a lot of periods in this region, but not that many pulse periods in this region. And you can see that even more clearly on this plot. Basically, this is a plot showing all the new pulsars in blue, the old known pulsars in white. This is period on this axis, and this is dispersion measure on this axis. The pulsars that we'd like to find, like the N157B pulsar, would be in this region here, short period, high dispersion measure, and we're not finding them. And that's because of these fundamental limits that I've described. That's right. We would only be sensitive to millisecond pulsars at very low DMs. And we've only, was that what you're asking? Yeah, that's right. So we don't expect to find a whole lot of millisecond pulsars. We've only found, in fact, there's actually a third one that we found, but anyway. So radio surveys, unless you're going to be able to go to high frequency where the flux is dying out, so you need a huge dish, you're not going to find a lot of these sources. But that's not to say we're not finding other interesting things, so I'll just flash that up. These are now the known pulsars with characteristic ages less than 100 kiloyears. We're finding lots of young pulsars, but not the very fast ones. Everything underlined in green is a new pulsar found as part of our survey. So to solve the initial spin period problem, this survey, although it's very productive, it's not going to do it, but it will do a lot of other interesting science. Anyway, so to summarize, what I hope I showed you, and I hope that's what was useful to you. The initial spin periods of radio pulsars are hard to know because you don't know the breaking indexes. Those are hard to measure because of timing irregularities in the rotation of the pulsar, glitches and timing noise. Also, you don't know the true ages of the pulsars. There's only one for which you really know the initial spin period, and that's the crab. Radio pulsar surveys, unfortunately, though very productive for other science, are just not that sensitive to fast, young pulsars. And when I mean faster than, you know, something like 10 milliseconds. It could be out there, but we couldn't detect them. Or we could only detect them within a limited volume compared to the rest of the pulsar population. However, X-rays, in particular the instruments XTE and XMM, possibly Chandra, but only possibly because a problem in their timing has recently been discovered that makes it challenging, if not impossible, to find pulsars faster than probably around 10 milliseconds or something like that and reduce sensitivity to others. That's a problem that might have a fix, but it's a big issue right now. Certainly these two instruments are more promising for finding young fast pulsars, and basically the X-ray regime where N157B was found is the place to be looking for more of them. So I'll stop there. Yes.
Was time used in order to find them?
Or yes.
Was it bright enough to just see the point source
actually? In some cases, there was a point source, and there was sufficient time resolution in the data to be able to detect the pulse. For example, in the case of the N157B pulsar, that was discovered not in a search of that particular supernova remnant, but rather in a search of 1987A. That's what they were really looking for. But the XTE field of view is so large, the XTE field of view is a degree, that they found that. Initially, they thought they found 1987A, and so were somewhat disappointed, I'm sure. But on the other hand, it was still very interesting. So in some cases, like that one, it's a little more serendipitous, but most of the cases in X-rays, because you can't do an all-sky, or it's much harder to do an all-sky high-time resolution survey in X-rays. So you're preferentially going to detect things that appear to be in supernova remnants in X-rays. So what should you do? You should go and look at every supernova remnant with very high-time resolution to find more of them, and that's something that I'm doing with Brian Gainsler, but we haven't found anything yet. Oh, that's true. It definitely, the magnetic field, you want a low magnetic field pulsar, yes. So you're asking, So are you asking what are the, or maybe you're just, that was just a comment, you're not really, okay. Yeah, I mean, the prospects for actually doing that anytime soon are nil.
USB satellite looking at any supernova remnants?
Well, unfortunately, they don't have the sort of infrastructure that the NASA missions do, and so you can't look at their long-term timeline and say it is. Yeah, I don't think, I mean, my strong impression is that the USA satellite is not more sensitive than XTE. So anything that USA could do, XTE could do better. Well, yeah, I don't know. XTE is asking for long projects in their last cycle, so it's possible USA could do it. But I mean, what I would, well, not to give away all my ideas, but what I would do with USA is, for example, sit on the N157B pulsar and get the breaking index. But anyway. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, look at the crab. You can't detect the shell of the crab. The crab, what you detect only is the Clarion. And if that pulsar hadn't been 10 to the 38 ergs per second, you wouldn't even see the shell. You don't see any shell now. So that when you can detect and when you can't detect supernova remnants, the known supernova remnant population is incomplete. There's no doubt about it. And it's not merely a distance effect either. Yeah, I mean, to first order, yes, that's true. On the other hand, if somehow we could verify that Andrew Lyne's method for measuring the breaking index in the Vela pulsar was reliable, then you could do it for a larger population of pulsars. How could we go about verifying that? I'm not sure. You could probably try and apply the exact same analysis to the crab, although it's easier to do in the crab, so you don't have as difficult a case. So, the simple answer is, it's not, the prospects aren't great. On the other hand, if you had, you know, several hundred years of timing data, then you could do it. So our grandchildren or great-grandchildren or whatever, if we're very diligent about timing pulsars, after a while the effect of the stationary term will dominate. But I wouldn't hold my breath for the next few years.
Can't you divide the period and a half for Vela and two for Delta, either two and a half to get the
same? Well, that's basically yes, and some people have, in fact, there was a recent paper by Johnston and Simon Johnston and collaborators, where you could say, okay, you don't need to have a phase coherent timing solution where you count every pulse in order to determine the second frequency derivative. Yes, ideally you'd like that to determine the second frequency derivative. Instead, if you could determine the frequency derivative at one epoch very, very well, and then at another epoch very, very well, and just subtract them, well, that's a second frequency derivative. You know, subtract and divide by time. So you could estimate the breaking index that way. The problem is that you're always, there is always contamination at any one epoch, or the duration of the epoch for which you can measure the frequency derivative is limited by the intervals between glitches in many sources. And not only that, the glitch recovery also contaminates. Now, you could call that timing noise, or you could call it something else. You could call it glitch recovery, but the value of the frequency derivative that you measure is contaminated. And so whether that's truly a very reliable method, you know, it's... Well, you could try, but... Yes. And that's essentially... Well, that's similar to what Andrew did. And so what all I'm saying is that if you want to introduce a new way of doing it, you'd like to be able to do it two ways and get the same number to believe it. In the end, yeah, that's right.
Get an average, which with some dispersion, give you some idea of what's going on, it might cost a little more.
Yeah, that's something that.
Various modelers have permanent changes in the document. People say there is no permanent change in the document. Trying to fit the post-stationary in the
document. Yes, that's true also. Yeah, that's all. That's another problem. Yeah.
That's why we're making slightly cynical noises. But if you had a good
David. Yeah.
Somebody somehow assembled a holistic suspect for pulsar. Would make it quicker when radio astronomers discovered it.
Globular clusters. Well, I could just say, in principle, if you had a good list, you would find pulsars faster if you had some other way of doing it. In practice, though, those sorts of targeted searches have been done by many people, including myself, and they're much less fruitful than just randomly searching. For example, you could try targeting the unidentified egret sources, because they're probably gamma ray pulsars. But not a single pulsar has been found in that way. And in fact, people have in gamma ray error boxes where people have searched and not found anything, the PM survey has gone and found a pulsar there. And that's, I mean, it's just because, well, for a variety of reasons. But we've searched, for example, I did a huge search of supernova remnants. We didn't find any. Part of the problem, for example, in searching supernova remnants is that the supernova remnant is bright and it adds noise. So you're sort of slightly selected for finding young pulsars that are not associated with bright supernova remnants. Well, it depends how bright it is, because the radio luminosity isn't well correlated with any other physical parameter. If it were very bright, you could detect it in a couple of minutes. Or seconds. Well, I mean... to slew parks? I don't know. 5 minutes? Depends where it was pointing last. Minutes. Yeah.
Catch a gamma ray burst optical flash.
Yeah, it's always there. It's It's not that if you knew where to look in advance, I mean, it's still non-trivial because you don't know the dispersion measure, you don't know the period.